I got back to Melbourne, I looked at all my mates and I was looking at them going, oh, bloody hell, man, I'm a failure. Because they've put in the hard yards. They went to uni. They've now got good jobs. You know, getting married or starting to have a family. I remember mum, I don't know if she could read it or not, but she said to me, it wasn't related to anything, but she said, you know what, Martin, it doesn't matter when you find it as long as you do. And those words I took as, hey, breathe. You're fine. You just haven't sorted it out yet. You're a late developer. And I've been late to every party I've ever been to.
Welcome to season 3 of the Let's Check In podcast, where we make sense of the messy, uncertain middle of modern life through candid conversations and expert insights. I'm your host, Susie McAvale. Let's check in. Many of us don't unravel because life gets hard. We unravel when life changes the plan and we're not quite sure who we are without it. My guest today, Martin Heppel, knows that territory well. Since 2016 through the Resilience Project, he's delivered more than 2,300 presentations across Australia to schools, communities, corporations and elite sporting organisations, helping people build practical skills for the moments that really test us. But beneath this role is a lived story that isn't neat or linear. Martin spent part of his childhood in Borneo, shaped by a world that teaches you to adapt, to read people and to stay connected. He then stepped into elite sport, St Kilda, Melbourne Football Club and Norwood, and met the kind of reality where you can love something completely and still not get to stay. What followed wasn't a quick reinvention. It was a stretch he sums up simply, lost, found, lost again, until I worked it out. And somewhere in that season, he became the person people experience today. Comfortable in his own skin, no pretense, the same person with kids, athletes, teachers, and executives. In this conversation, Martin shares why feeling lost is part of being human. He unpacks how resilience is built through small daily actions, not necessarily big breakthroughs. And he explains why connection and emotional awareness matter more than trying to be strong. Martin, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here on the Let's Check In podcast.
Thanks, Susie. Appreciate your time.
So, before we get into, I guess, the Resilience Project, which is a really huge part of your life, what do you hope people feel in the first 5 minutes of them meeting you?
I suppose quite often it's fear, it's trepidation, because they're looking at me going, mate, this bloke's the loosest unit alive. He talks at 100 miles an hour. He sounds like a bogan. I don't know if I'm going to connect to him. Look, various, it's a hard one. It depends on who it is. With the kids, I'm getting down to their level. I'm looking in the eye. I'm shaking their hands. I want them to know that I see them, that they're valued, that they're heard. And that's really important. I want them to know that they're accepted for who they are. And obviously that's the same with adults, but adults are a little bit different because quite often they're coming in with their world already shaped by certain experiences and those experiences are theirs. I don't know what their background is. I've got to try and get on point with them and connect with them real quick. Sometimes it takes certain people in the audience longer, sometimes they don't. And I've got to get better at acknowledging that I'm not going to be liked by everyone. I think for me, work, it's, I just don't know if that one day that person needs me to bring it. And if I go into that gig and I'm not bringing it and it's just I'm going through the motions or I've had a bad night, the kids have been up all night or whatever it may be, but I still can't find my mojo, if I still can't bring it, then that might be one person who on that particular day needed it and I may have let them down.
It's your drive.
Yeah, it is. And care, because it does help some people.
What I get from that is that you leave assumption at the door. That's the first thing. Second one in there is it's very difficult for us to sit with not being liked, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. When I first started, you know, doing presentations, I'd focus on the negative too much, whether that be an email or during the I watch everyone in my presos like a hawk. I'm watching for body language. I'm watching the twitch. I'm trying to work out, you know, how it's landing. At the beginning, that really grated me and I'd almost go after them and I shouldn't have. But in my mind, I'd be like, right, I'm going to turn you. And the bigger the presentation, the easier it is. I had a person answer their phone one time and then took the phone call and then told me put their finger up like this, as if to say to me whilst I was presenting to 400 people, no, no, can you wait until I finish the conversation?
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah. And that I went, I didn't handle that well. So
I'm not. What did you do in that?
I wasn't good. I basically said to them that, what, you want me to stop, do you? Yeah, no worries, I'll stop. Yeah, I'll just stop whilst everyone in this room, 400 of us, will stop whilst you can finish that conversation, or you can pick up the mobile phone. It's a mobile phone. Why? Because it's mobile and you can get mobile and take the phone call out of the room. I don't care that you don't listen to what I'm saying, but I do care if someone next to you does care and they can't hear because you're having a conversation. It's all about you. And with all due respect, if you had the mic and I had the phone, I'd get up and walk out. But in this case, I don't have the phone. I've got the mic. So if you don't mind, could you please stand up and walk out? And everyone in the audience got really awkward.
Oh, I thought you were going to say they either clapped or like,
and I don't
cut the air with a knife.
It's up in Queensland, and I haven't been invited back since, so I don't know what's going there. And then you make mistakes and you get better. But I think going back to it, my DNA, what I've got to remind myself always is if I can look myself in the mirror every night and whoever it is that I've been with on that day, if I've given them my all, yeah, then I'm okay. Now, giving my all is not going to be perfect. Giving my all is not going to be the right thing to do all the time, right? And therefore, I've got to have the courage, self-awareness to reflect on it and go, you know what, I didn't do that well. Hey, get back to them, check in. Hey, this is where I was trying to land. I apologize if that's the case. But also have some transparency there, but then listen to them, how I made them feel, and then I get better because then the next time I'm in a situation possibly and if I'm acting that way, if I'm saying certain things, I can remember, hey, you went down this path previously and it didn't land with everyone. Be careful. Yeah, so I don't know. But hey,
that's great. I mean, to be curious and to be able to hold that and be conscious of it and then go back and say, hey, listen, I'm really sorry about that. There's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I think I learned it from my dad because my dad never said sorry, right? And he's a legend. I love him. But I would always say sorry even when I knew I was right, like 100% I was right. But I had to say sorry because then we wouldn't get moving forward, yeah? We'd stay in the mire, in the mud. And I remember saying it to him and then over time, you know, he's 84 now. He still struggles with it, but he starts to say sorry. And then I'm trying to teach my four kids, even when you haven't done anything wrong, it's okay to say sorry because you're showing that you care. But then if you show them that you care, then they're more likely to open up, yeah? And there's, you know, I think if they don't come back to the party and acknowledge their side, well, then that's a different, you know, conversation.
Yeah.
But quite often it's giving them a leaning into moment where they can come in and go, you know what? Hey, he's not standing on his pedestal here. You know, he hasn't got all the answers. He's saying, hey, I played a part in this.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so maybe if he's willing to play, put his hand up and say he played a part in it, maybe I could also say, hey, you know what? I'm willing as well.
Vulnerability.
Yeah.
Hey?
Yeah. And self-awareness is massive, man.
A lot of skills that a lot of us can kind of still grow on to, myself included.
This season of the Let's Check In podcast is proudly supported by Polito Group, a Melbourne-based commercial cleaning company. What connected me with Adrian and Marty, the founders of Polito Group, is that they don't just see cleaning as maintenance. They see it as caring for the environments that people spend their time in. And that aligns deeply with this podcast. Because the spaces that we work in affect how we feel, how we think, and how we show up each day. Polito Group has built its reputation on relationships, consistency, and genuine care. Not just for their clients, but for the people and their team as well. They're currently offering listeners the chance to win $1,000 towards a professional commercial clean for a new retail, hospitality, or commercial space. You can find out the latest competition details via a link in the show notes, or you can go directly to @PolitoGroup on Instagram and check out their link in bio. Now, let's continue the conversation.
You work with kids, you work with teachers, athletes, execs, a vast array of people, very different rooms often, which is what you were kind of alluding to before. What's the one thing you've learnt about people that really applies in every one of those situations?
That I know their world, but I'm not the saviour. I'm not on my perch talking down to them, that I'm with them, that I'm flawed. When they know that, then they're on more often than not. They're willing to listen. I've got to have some intel that they can believe is going to help them, I've got to put it into a real life experience for them that they can connect to. Crucial, that which goes back to what I was saying before about knowing their world. And then I've got to give them belief that there's ways that it can be done and that it's achievable. And that if they do it, they'll then get the benefits from it. That's basically in an essence. And so, you know, with the kids, it's taking the mickey out of myself. It's being funny in front of them with humour that they relate to. Them knowing that I know what they do when they come to school, what they're thinking about in the car, getting off the bus, if they're an adolescent at high school, you know, social media, it's going flat stick, their ways at this moment and how they're trying to navigate it, get around it, get back on, having the fake ID to get into the nightclub, elite sport, it's identity, it's them, you know, depending on the room, they're all different because you've got some who are just fighting for their life to get another contract and they're so worried about whether or not they're going to stay on. It's the others who are at the top of the perch. They've got a contact negotiations coming through. The older crew who are coming to retirement, they're worried about what they're going to do next. It's the coaches in the room. They don't know, they're under the heat from the media. If they don't perform this year, the boards are going to come after them. Teachers, they're burnt out. Are they still in? Are they not still in? Do they get on with their team teachers? There's a change in leadership. Are they going to come in and ask me to do something different? I'm pretty comfortable in my role right now. I don't want my role to change. Leadership change, that means I change. I don't like that. The leaders in the room, they're trying to navigate change. They're trying to get everyone on board. Corporate, same applies to them. Sometimes it's coin, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's the mortgage, sometimes it's divorce, sometimes it's separation. I'm seeing the kids, I'm not seeing the kids. I wish I could see the kids more. It's the whole gamut. It's cost of living. It's everything. It's judgment. It's when I drop the kids off at primary school, I walk on in there and everyone's got the 2XU gear on, but now it's Lululemon. What's it going to be next? I need the Range Rover. Everyone else got the Range Rover. Why can't I have the Range Rover? We go to the barbecue. Everyone's turning up. They got this. We don't have that. I'm in this neck of the woods now. I need that. If I add that, I walk in, I feel like I'm valued. It's just knowing what they care about. That's hard, but it can be done. And then in a perfect world, it's getting them to not worry about the superficial crap. The real stuff, 100% I'm with you. That's real. But let go of all that other stuff and let's dial in on what matters. Now, if you're lucky and what matters is going well, then you are okay. So let go. All right? Now, if what matters isn't going well, then I'm with you 100%. So here are the things that we can do to help each other.
Let's talk about those.
I know this, that if I'm having a bad day, the thing that will give me hope is positive emotions, and that is crucial. Now, if I don't have those positive emotions consistently, then those negative emotions are overriding everything, and then it's permanence where I believe that, oh, it was yesterday, it's today, it's going to be tomorrow. Oh, this is just the way it's going to be. I always get the bad luck. Hey, what's the point? Hey, let's give up. Yeah. I'm doomed. So what we want everyone to be aware of is that there are good things in their world. And yes, it is hard at certain times to see it. But if it becomes embedded, that is, the strategies that you can implement to gain insight into the things that you do have, being grateful, focusing on what you've got, yeah, then you're on. And it's not materialism. It's not the roof over your head. It's experiences as well. It's also the love. It's the gestures that other people do for you. It's going home and seeing the sunset when you didn't see it four nights earlier. It's understanding that you came home and the kids actually clean up their room and you didn't even drop that dime on them. But for some reason today they did it, yeah? It's knowing that, hey, you got every single bus in and the traffic was better than it has been. Whatever it may be, if you can find the wins, you can then focus on that and you get that positive emotion. The positive emotions then allow you to know that, hey, there are good things out there in this world. And it's seasonal. I firmly believe this, and I don't say this in presentations because I think it's corny, but like we talk about gratitude, empathy and kindness and mindfulness, and I got that when I was living in Borneo.
Yeah.
Because that's how the tribe lived. They had to. If you wanted to eat, you were bloody lucky to get a wild boar, yeah? And then they'd share it with everyone.
How old were you when you were in Borneo?
Well, from day dot. Well, not day dot, but one, two, and then back and forth until basically – you know, year eight.
And why Borneo?
Because my dad's an anthropologist and he was studying the tribe. So mum and dad were living with them. And the tribe were amazing. They were headhunters. They weren't when we, you know, once my brother and I were born. But they were prior to that. And they're the kindest people my mum and dad ever met. They loved life. They loved it. Had a zest for life. You know, they had energy. But there were no distractions. You know, none. I mean, and it's in the 60s and 70s and the 80s when I was there. Mm. There were no distractions. Right. So you were in the moment and you loved it. You'd go down the river and the sun would be shining through the rainforest and, you know, Gudjo, one of the blokes, I don't forget this, he came down with a wild boar. And if you're a vegetarian, I'm sorry, but it happens, man. All right, so they're in the jungle and they're eating meat. So I respect a vegan, vegetarian without doubt, but that's what they did. So hopefully you respect what they did. And that you know, they'd heat the wild boar up on a fire and you'd eat it by the river and, mate, you'd swim in the river, that, you know, and the other blokes would be coming down the longboat, Sumpan and Gudjo, and, you know, they had the local fish, what they call it, carn, and you'd have all this fresh fish. You'd go up and everyone looked after each other. And so the other thing we talk about is empathy, and empathy is, hey, I'm not going through what you're going through, but if I can listen to you and if I can identify the emotions that you're experiencing, I'm more likely to be kind. So what they did is they had massive barnies and it was on.
Did they?
Massive. Like huge barnies. I mean, on for young and old.
Yeah.
But then they would talk about it and they'd see it through each other's eyes, their lens, and then they'd move forward. And so all the research with empathy is that your brain releases oxytocin when you do something kind for someone. You can't be kind if you're not empathetic, more often than not. When your brain releases oxytocin, you know, your self-esteem, your energy levels go through the roof. The gratitude is, I didn't talk about that. If you keep it simplistic, it's write down three things at the end of every day that went well, small things. Do it for 21 days. Your brain starts to rewire. You scan the world for the positives. You think about, for all of us, when we get feedback, if I gave you feedback and seven forms of it was positive, you'd probably be up and about, but then I give you one form that's negative. When you walk out of the room, what do you focus on? So it's not saying, hey, there's no feedback. Don't worry about the negative feedback. I forget about it. It's like, yeah, mate. All right, respond to that, but there's some other stuff that's good,
mm-hmm.
right? And when we do it for a sustained period of time, you become more optimistic. Optimism gives you hope. Hope you don't give up. I want every kid that I work with, that we work with as a company, that every kid that we don't work with, I want them to have hope. I want them to believe that, hey, there is some good out there. Hey, I know it's tough at the moment and it will be tough. It bloody is tough. And everyone's going to experience some rough moments without doubt. And for my four kids, they are going to have them. And I want them to have them. I don't know. That sounds really mean.
No, but makes sense. It's gonna have to go through the fire. Got to
go through it. Yeah. So, but do you know what to do to get through that? And then, so if you can display gratitude, if you can be empathetic, you get the positive emotions and the mindfulness. You know, a lot of people have different, you know, definitions of it. Again, you know, there's many and varied, but it's just knowing that there's things that you can do to be right here, right now. So, it's also knowing there's things that the kids can do, that I can do, that you can do. When you're having disruptive thoughts, when you experience anxiety, and then when you practice these strategies and you see the benefits of them, this is crucial. When you see the benefits of them, you're then more likely to activate them again, utilize them when the time requires it in the future, because you know what to do. I get anxious, yeah, without doubt. What's anxiety for me? Uncertainty. Bloody oath. Like, you chuck uncertainty in the mix and it gets anyone. And anyone who says that they don't care about it, they're talking crap, 100% talking crap.
We're wired as humans,
yeah.
Right?
Unless you don't care about anything or anyone, right? But if you care about something or someone, then the uncertainty is what grabs us all. So what we do know is that if you can put that into play with the mindfulness, then you're allowed to get through it. And then, you know, you talked at the beginning about the connection piece. The connection helps you with that because you're not alone. Yeah, so if you're willing to share that you're going through a hard time, like I did it a couple of weeks ago. I was going through some stuff and I shared it with my mates. And when I shared it with my mates, it didn't make it go away. It didn't disappear, but I knew they had my back. You know, my brother and, you know, a couple of my close mates, but, you know, they knew what was going on. They knew the time frame. They checked in on me and people from work checked in with me. And so I felt better, yeah? And so if you can do that and know that you're not being judged, and know that whatever you share with, depending on what the topic is, but if it is vault, it is vault with those that you trust. But the first step of that is the hardest in any relationship because you don't know the outcome, which goes back to uncertainty, because what we fear as humans is being left in the lurch or being judged or being exposed, and then that exposure is being utilized or used against us. And if that is, I say you're bloody lucky because you just found out the person you shared it with, they're a wanker and you shouldn't trust them again in the future. So I'd be flat, but then I'd just put a line through them and go to my next mate.
Yeah. Great advice. I think we can all really relate to that one. No. That element of being more than just cleaning. What are those things?
We're a commercial cleaning company. It's been all about strength in relationships, what we can do in our offerings, and actually how we deliver the end result, which is probably the biggest problem in cleaning. Not everybody loves what they do. And I think for our cleaners, showing them that environment and being able to make them feel like they're not just cleaners for us has been key.
Mm.
That's something that we're really, really big on. Not because we don't think that they're going to love or enjoy their job, but it's just there are so many external factors to working. Doesn't matter if you're a cleaner, CEO, director, everyone's got lives outside of their work. So as long as we can make the environment that they enter a good environment that's happy and they enjoy, then we've done our job.
It sounds like the culture is really important to you.
Massive.
Definitely.
Yeah. Let's flip to a time in your life after footy where it didn't continue. And you used a line that I mentioned before. You were lost, you were found, and then you were lost again until I worked it out. What did lost look like for you in that moment?
It was identity. So I was playing footy. Footy stopped. And I was probably done with footy, but I mean, I wasn't good enough. That was it. But that's all I'd done, right? And when I was only 21, but I loved footy, playing up. You know, my brother and I would go to the park every night. We'd play sliding chess marks in the mud. We'd pour with rain. Mum would yell at us, "Dinner's on the table!" And we'd still be down there till 8:30 at night. We'd climb this tower, and she'd always go, "You're gonna electrocute yourself one day." And we go, "Well, we haven't tonight, Mum." You know, and we loved it. Like, we absolutely loved it. And then I love playing with my mates. I love being part of a team with people that you cared about. I loved the us and them mentality when I was younger. You know, this is our posse, our hood, and we're gonna look after everyone. And I love being the underdog. I've thrived with the underdog. I love that. But then, you know, then I went and played at St Kilda and Melbourne, then went over to Norwood. But it stopped, and I wanted to go travelling. I love adventure. I suppose growing up with my mum and my dad, you know, dad's, you know, worked a lot overseas in all the stans, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, India and Nepal and, you know, various parts of Southeast Asia, subcontinent. And so we'd go travelling with him sometimes when he was over there. And my mum's American, dad's English, no relatives in Australia, all overseas. So my brother and I were like, let's go.
You got couches to go and sleep on.
Yeah, we did. We had many. And we just were after the adventure. But also we didn't know what we were doing. And I think at that time, like a lot of my mates didn't do this, especially the ones I went to school with. They all went to uni and then they got their jobs. It was a university degree, 100% it was. It was about reading people, about learning about the importance of body language, because we'd have to do that to communicate. Watching people, we'd go to different areas and I'd watch. I remember sitting in one of the old towns in Rhodos in the Greek islands, and we just sat there, my brother and I, for like hours playing shishbish, backgammon, but we'd watch people and we'd see how actions brought out different emotions. Yeah, and we learned, hey, if you do this, it'll make that bloke smile. If you do that, it won't make him smile. And that served us well wherever we went when we didn't know the languages. So we'd have our eyes up. It taught us about having your eyes up, how important it is. Nowadays, we don't do that. I talk to my kids about that so much, about they don't have phones. I'm going to hold off for as long as I can. But when you've got a phone, you don't have your eyes up. And your eyes aren't up, you don't see the world. You don't see how people react. You don't see another human being who needs assistance, whatever it may be. But you learn so much about people when you watch them. Yeah, if you watch people, you learn, hey, how they operate. You see that, hey, that was done and they didn't like it. You know, man, now not to do that to that person. Yeah, or vice versa. They came into that room and this person did this. It made them really comfortable. Right? Or they're talking about that, whatever it may be. So I think that's really important. So for us, we were doing that. We experienced so much adversity and so many amazing stories. You know, I'm not going to get into them because it'd take 5 days, but – mate, we had some hardcore moments where it was sketchy, but we went away and we learned so much, but we ran out of money. Like, we worked, we ran out of money, and we were lucky because mum and dad were footing a lot of the bills. When we came home, my brother and I owed our parents a lot of money, and mum sat us down, and on the very first day we got back, she pulled out all the Westpac credit card, printed sheets back then, and she gave it to us. She said, "Well, you've had your fun now. Now it's time to pay back. But hey, don't get flat. Think about all the fun you had." And so it took me a bloody long time to pay it back, but we did. And so when I came back, so when I was footy was I was lost, didn't know what I wanted to do, went away, I wanted to go traveling. When I was traveling, I just wanted to have fun, meet people, have adventures, see, I love natural landscapes and I love people. I'm not really into the art, which really annoyed my brother. I went to the Sistine Chapel and, mate, it was great. But then I walked out of there because I was done with it and I went to the pub and I love Liverpool and I'll never forget it, but Danny Murphy for Liverpool scored the winner against Arsenal at Highbury and I'm in a pub in Rome and I was going ballistic and then Mal came back with one of my mates, Daltz, and cracked it at me and said, oh, you should have stayed longer. It's phenomenal. It's historical. I was like, what are you talking about, mate? I just had the best day of my life. Danny Murphy just scored the 87th minute and we beat Arsenal. So my brother and I, we were thick as thieves. It consolidated our relationship. We had so many Barneys. We learned to realise that we were different, but we were so similar. Him and I, we always did before that, but that really consolidated our love for each other. Like, we've got each other's backs forever. He's the younger brother, but he's the older brother. And we both came back. He had his, I think he had more direction than me when we got back. But when I got back after having fun, having adventures, meeting amazing people, then I really was lost because I then stuffed up because I started that world of comparison. And I got back to Melbourne, I looked at all my mates and I looked at them, I was like, mate, I'm not where they are because they didn't do what I did. They hadn't had the adventures. And we've had these chats, you know, afterwards, but in that moment, I didn't realise they were envious of what I did because I had all these experiences they didn't have. But I was looking at them going, oh, bloody hell, man, I'm a failure. Because they've put in the hard yards. They went to uni. They've now got good jobs. I was 28. You know, getting married or starting to have a family. And, mate, no girl wanted to hang out with me. And fair enough too. And, you know, I had a person say I looked like a dead dog in a gutter.
Oh,
and
God.
No, it was legitimate. I've got no problem with
that's
it.
That's rich.
But then I'll never forget it. I got kicked out of a house. When I say kicked out, the lease ran out. I went back, stayed at mum and dad's for, you know, a couple of months. And then I was thinking, you know, I'm 28 and I'm back at home. I was walking our dogs. We loved the West Indies growing up. Kirtley and Ambrose were our dogs. And I remember mum, I don't know if she could read it or not, but she said to me, it wasn't related to anything, but she said, you know what, Martin, it doesn't matter when you find it as long as you do. And those words I took as, hey, breathe, you're fine. You just haven't sorted it out yet. You're a late developer. And I've been late to every party I've ever been to. So for me, it was that self-talk. It was that self-belief. There was someone who had my back, which was my parents. In that moment, it was my mum's words. All my real mates, they didn't judge me. They had my back. And then I just, my self-talk activated. My self-talk was, mate, let's go. Let's find out. So I started doing every job under the sun, jobs I didn't enjoy. But I worked out that, hey, I need to get back and get an education because I don't enjoy doing these jobs. And I started working with kids and I loved it and I was good at it, but it was all word of mouth. At that stage, I wanted to go traveling again. That's what I had in the back of my mind. And I knew that if I went traveling, I couldn't necessarily work with kids because I had to start from the get-go again because I had no degree. So I went back and did primary school teaching. And throughout this whole stage, this was me trying to work out what the heck, who I was, what I was doing.
Did you feel like that was your purpose?
I don't think I discovered it as of yet, but I knew that I was okay at it, working with kids. I knew that I could get them on board and I enjoyed it. I'm young at heart.
Yeah.
And then I reckon when it was, I started working with a boy whose name's Jeremy, who's probably my idol. I was his teacher, but in the end, he's my teacher. It was one of those relationships where there's a lot of stuff that he can't do, but he taught me again about gratitude, about focusing on what you can do. He's the most amazing human being I've ever met in my life. I've been so lucky to know him, to know his family. He's like my North Star. He reminds me of why I do what I do. And I think I started to realise that my purpose was to work with human beings, to work with kids when I was working with him because I can give him something but he gives me something as well. That was 19 years ago. I loved the bloke so much. And then, so then I started working with kids and in primary school in particular, I knew I've got them. I still speak to some of the kids I taught back in 2008, you know, and I've got their back forever. What I always would say to myself is that none of these kids chose to have me. None of them chose to have me as their teacher. I chose to have them. So getting back to what I said at the very beginning, mate, you bring your A game.
You did bring your A game because you shot up through the ranks very quickly when you look at your – because you went to AP.
I was assistant principal. There was circumstances to that, like the way the school was and whatnot. But it was just turning up. You know, I remember I only was hungover, I think it was twice or three times. I never missed a day of school. Like if I went out and had a beer the night before and I didn't do it often, but if I did, I went to school the next day.
Yeah.
Because I was like, man, if they're turning up, I'm turning up. Like half of them would turn up when they were crook. And I remember like twice I did it when I was really struggling. And I lived in Hawthorne across the street called the Rocket Park. And I'd go across there and I'd run until I'd vomit, which is disgusting, but I'd do that until I'd get it all out of my system and then I'd turn up to school because I was like, mate, these kids turn up for me, I'm turning up for them. And then I remember one day I said to a kid, I'll never forget him, his name was, I won't say his surname, his name was Timmy and he was in grade one, I taught grade one, two kid. And I said to him, now listen, guys, I'm just giving you a heads up, don't roll the dice today. Like, do not. Like, my patience is thin. I didn't say why. I said, I didn't sleep last night. I'm just giving you a heads up. Just take it easy. All right. And then this kid, Timmy, goes, he's in grade one. Are you saying we should feel sorry for you, Mr. Heppel? And I was like, no, no, no. And before I could say no, he said, feel sorry for you. You should feel sorry for me. I got a lift in the car today to school with my dad. And the whole way here, I had to listen to the Seekers. And in that moment, and I backed that moment, is that, if I ever feel bad in front of the kids or crook, mate, think about them. Like, and now there's always humor with kids. There's always, if you are willing to open the door and allow them to walk through, they'll bring you back. But yeah, I mean, so then, yeah, and started teaching. And that's when I realized what it was all about for me. And it's helping others. And in particular, what I'm passionate about, mega passionate about, is helping the kids. I just want them to know that they're awesome. I want them to know that they're just to be comfortable in your own skin. But to be comfortable in your own skin, you've got to know that I and others have got your back. And then it's up to me, I suppose, to get adults in particular to see it through the kids' world. And where we as adults stuff up is when we don't.
What's your thinking around the responsibilities? Because in those scenarios that you're talking about, sometimes it can feel like you've got the whole weight of the world on your shoulders, particularly when talking about coming back from overseas and seeing your mates and seeing what they've got. And that aspect, I think, is an interesting one of, I was only talking about this with one of my best mates the other day, about relinquishing the reins and just being like, you know what, maybe not yet.
Yeah.
And maybe this isn't all up to me. Maybe there's some bigger plan out there that we don't even know about.
Everyone's different, but for me, expectations are a nightmare. So I remember sitting down with my prin, who was awesome, but she'd say to me, what's your five-year goal? And I used to infuriate her because I said, I haven't got one. I don't even know what I'm doing today. Where I'm coming from is that I go paddling a lot, right, in a surf ski, and surf skis are really tippy, right, because they're thin. And when you go with me here. But when you go in a surf ski and you paddle, especially when you're catching waves, if you fight against it, when you feel like you're going out, if you're going to fall out, you always go in. But if you let the boat, if you go with the boat, if you go with your ski, if you go sideways, but if you keep paddling, when you paddle, even when you think you're going to go in, when that oar, the paddle hits the water, it brings you back in. It centers you again back into the ski.
Yeah.
Right? And so for me, when you're going through the churn, when you're going through some rough times, it's knowing that they're not going to last, but you've got to be in it, right? And it's letting it take you wherever it goes. It's the wave taking you where it goes. But keep paddling, and one of your strokes, when you hit that water, it's going to bring you back. But if you don't paddle and if you fight against it, you're going in, yeah? And I think that for me is what I live by now. And I think where I was really lucky is that I've never had expectations. Maybe when I was playing footy, I put some on, but I don't regret any of that. I have no regret. I regret if I hurt another human being's feelings or hurt them, but I have no regrets in terms of things that have happened to me. They've happened and I find the good in them eventually or right away. But I think when that time comes, if you have expectations and you're not living up to them, well, then you're stuffed. Because you feel you're a mile away from them. But if you just keep churning, you just go, you know what? Hey, it's rough at the moment, but I'm going to get through this. And I want to aspire to get to somewhere. I want to have goals, but goals are great because goals sometimes aren't achievable. I love having lofty goals. I don't get them, but I'll chase them, you know, whatever that may be. you know, back in the day, whether it be for a 4K time trial, whatever it may be, you know, go for it. But if you don't get it, chin up, go again. Self-assess and go, all right, I need to change this and I might get there. And then sometimes you realize, hey, that goal is just not achievable. And I think that's the other one, is that some things in life can't be done. They can't be done. I'm not for one to have a ceiling. Go for it, man. But I cannot touch my toes. If I keep stretching every night, I might be able to, yeah? But I know right here, right now, I'll never, in my physical condition at 51 years of age, I'm not going to run the times I used to run when I was in my when I was 18, I was weighing 69 kilo, or whatever it may be, right? Whatever that life. So, mate, get over it. And now what do you want to go for?
In your work, do you see a lot of people with unrealistic expectations?
I see a lot of people trying to be someone who they're not, and that's been shaped by others. And others is the company they work for. Might be corporate, might be not. It might be the industry that they're in. It might be social media. It might be what all their mates talk about, and all their mates are only talking about because that's what they think everyone else should be talking about. It's a fad. And what the hardest thing to do in life is to go against the grain, and that's the best thing my mum and my dad ever taught me, is to go against the grain. Not deliberately, but if it's right. If it is right, you go against the grain. Yeah, you roll hard, man. And that is the way to go if it's right. And I'm comfortable to do that. So what does that look like? That's standing up to gossip. That's standing up to, I suppose, behaviours that might not be right. That's saying something that might not be popular in that moment, but mate, might be the right thing to do. And I find it hard sometimes, without doubt. It comes back to, well, is it right? Yeah. I've got two role models, and like my dad, he's a different unit. Like he got blacklisted in Canberra when we moved there because he found out that the government were doing something that wasn't ethical. And so he went on the record and told the Canberra Times about it, and his career suffered and he couldn't get work down there for 2 years, right? And then I found, because I was cleaning up mum and dad's house, we're going through some stuff, a job reference from a bloke in Canberra about my dad. And when you talk about pride, this is the thing that I'm really proud about my dad. It said, this man in all of Canberra, he is incorruptible. Now, when I read that, it's not about being incorruptible. It's about standing by what you believe in, even if you have to suffer consequences. So what I learned from my dad, going back to him being blacklisted in Canberra, is that the consequences of him not having any employment, everyone back in the UK saying, come home, everyone saying, mate, you got two kids, what are you doing? You're living off your veggie patch in your backyard. Those consequences were not as significant, were not as important as him having to look himself in the mirror and know that he knew that something was going on that wasn't right, and he kept his mouth shut.
Bloody hell. Talk about integrity.
That's what it's about, and that's bloody hard, man. That is the hardest thing to do, the hardest thing to do. And people suffer. I mean, people are suffering everywhere around the world with that, right? And there's so many amazing people who suffer from that. So bring it back to our world. When we're in Australia, and don't get me wrong, there's some bloody, you know, horrific things that do occur, have occurred, et cetera. But in your world, yeah, how do you want to roll? How do you want to roll? Yeah, and you have to look yourself in the mirror. Now, we're all shaped by our values and our morals. Yeah, we are. But what are yours? I'm not saying to you, Susie, but I'm saying for me, what are my morals, my values? They're shaped by my parents, they're shaped by my experiences. And then my duty is to then live by them, but also portray them, model them every single day with my mates, with my family, and especially model them to my kids. And they're going to hate it.
They will.
Because I'm going to say, go against the grain. And they're going, Dad, but everyone is doing this. I go, I know, mate. So what are you going to do? Hey, you do what you got to do, man. But hey, if it's the right thing to do and no one else is doing it, then just know this, I have got your back. So now I'm not saying they're going to do that, because for a kid, what's really hard is that they care more about their peers, their colleagues, than me. And I get that because they're spending every day with them in the classroom or on the bus or on the way to school. But if you can get an adolescent to be comfortable in their own skin, if you can get an adolescent to know what their morals and their values are and to more often than not roll by them, then I don't care what ATASCA you get.
Yeah.
Mate, you're on.
So true.
Like, mate, that's my view on it anyway.
Yeah. We ask one question to everyone who comes and sits in this seat, and that is, what are you feeling uncertain about at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and how are you best supporting yourself?
Well, my wife would say health anxiety because my wife's a bit younger than me, but you know, we've been together for about 20 odd years, but I've got 4 kids and I've got a 10, an 8, a 5 and a 1-year-old, and I just want to be there for them. I've got a mate in Italy. I love him. He's got MND. And I've got another friend who, you know, had a brain tumor 2 years ago who passed away. And so you get to this age and you start seeing stuff like that and you start to worry, because all I want is that to be there for my kids. Now, that's big picture. What am I doing about it? Well, you know, it's knowing that there's some things that aren't in your control. There are some things that are. Get onto it. But it's also, you got to live, man. Because as my mate Shimmy in Italy said to me, the second last time I saw him when I flew over there, he's still alive now, but before he lost his voice, he had his forehead next to my forehead and he was blowing his eyes out, and I was blowing my eyes out. And he said to me, you got to live your life. You got to live your life. So for me, I got to live. I got to have fun. I want to have fun with my kids. I want to cash in, make the most of it. But then also the uncertainty is that I just want to be there for them forever. Because my parents are still alive and they're still my mentors. I'm so bloody lucky. I know that won't be the case with me with my kids. If I'm alive when Greta's 50, mate, I'm 100. I've done bloody well, man.
Done very well. But you might.
So yeah, you never know. Yeah, hey, your dad's 85. I'm rolling for it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, that's the uncertainty. I mean, it grabs me in moments, I'm not going to lie. Not all day, every day, but in moments that uncertainty grabs me. But then I get back to Shimmy and it's, hey, come on, man, live. Let's go. Let's have some fun.
Martin, what you've reminded us today is that resilience isn't about having it all figured out. It's about staying connected, paying attention to what's going on inside us, and taking those small, steady steps, especially when it feels maybe a little bit unsettled. If today's conversation resonated, you can learn more about Martin's work and the Resilience Project, including their programs built around gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness, at theresilienceproject.com.au. Martin, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
No, thanks for your time, Susie. Appreciate it. Cheers.
We hear a lot in conversations like these, but often the part that stays with us are the simplest. Before we finish, I want to leave you with this. We talk about resilience like it's something dramatic, a breakthrough, a comeback, a big turning point. But this conversation with Martin, it reminds us that it's usually much simpler than that. It's what we do when life doesn't go to plan, when you feel lost, when you're comparing yourself to everyone else, when you don't have that clarity yet. Martin's message is powerful because it strips resilience right back to the basics. Stay connected, notice what's still good, keep showing up, and trust that feeling lost doesn't mean that you're failing. It might just mean that you're in the middle of becoming something else. Thanks for checking in with me today. If you haven't already, hit follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if this conversation resonated, share it with someone you'd like to check in on. You'll find guest details, resources, and the link to the Let's Check In newsletter in the show notes. You can also follow along on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Let's Check In Podcast. Before you go though, a gentle reminder, this podcast is not a licensed mental health service and it is not a substitute for professional advice. If something has come up for you in this episode and this season, please reach out for support. In Australia, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.